Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to Series 2 of my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen. A podcast made in collaboration with my great friends, the amazing charity Help Musicians. In this episode, I'm joined by an amazing singer-songwriter and a fabulous guitarist. He put out his first record in 1968. He was 19 years old, and that was with his first band, Fairport Convention. 3 years later, he left the band to start a solo career. He's been covered by people like David Byrne, Bonnie Raitt, and R.E.M. It's been a long and rich and highly acclaimed career. And here to talk about his songwriting is Richard Thompson. Hey, there you are.
There I am, exist. Hooray!
You exist.
How are you doing?
Lovely to see you.
Oh, I like your space there. There are lots of interesting stuff in the background. Right, very good.
Yeah, that's my shed. So, Richard Thompson, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, which is a podcast for Help Musicians. How are you?
I'm absolutely fine. Thank you for having me, as they say.
It's a real treat. So, because it's the festival season, my first question to you was, what was the first festival that you went to?
This was I went to. Gosh. Ooh la la. I think the first one I went to was one I was playing at, really. I never went as a member of the public until later. It could have been, gosh, maybe the first Isle of Wight Festival in whatever that was, 68?
Wow, who was on the bill there?
That's the festival that nobody talks about. It was Jefferson Airplane.
Wow, that's amazing.
It ran staggeringly late, you know. It was supposed to, you know, finish at midnight, and it finished about 6 in the morning. Someone miscalculated somewhere. Ainsley Dunbar was on, I seem to remember. I can't remember who else was on. It was hideous weather, you know, like typical, you know, August in Britain. And, yeah. You know, windswept and gruesome. That might have been the first one. Or it could have been the Rome Pop Festival. Maybe that was the first one, which was held in Rome. And lots of interesting people were on. The Move were on. The Association were on. Some really terrible, like, Italian bands were on.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a disaster bit because they put it in the Palazzo del Sport, which holds about 20,000. Mm. And they got about 2,000 people turn up.
Mm.
At one point, you know, the Move went into their act, which involved chopping up a TV set on stage. At which point, you know, they sent in the riot police.
Really?
Yeah. The riot police, you know, stormed the stage, like, you know, arrest everybody. Arrest half the audience. I managed to slip out the back quietly without getting arrested. And that was the end of the festival in that venue. And they had to switch to a little club in town, to the Piper Club in town for the rest of it. The Birds were on as well, which was great. The Birds in their country persona. It was just after Sweetheart of the Rodeo came out. So they had Graham Parsons in the band.
Oh, my God. Did you get to meet him?
Yeah, it was great. You know, we were hanging out backstage in the warm spring weather of Rome. It was, interesting guy. You know, he was a guy on a mission, clearly, you know, to kind of blend country and rock, you know, or to rehabilitate country music in America, where at that point it had a real redneck reputation, I suppose.
It did, yeah.
Anyway, that's an incredibly long answer to your very nice question. Thank you.
Well, no, it's true. I mean, festivals used to be behind picket fences. I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember the first one I went to and played at was the Windsor Free Festival.
And yeah,
that was
okay.
In Windsor Park. There was about 500 hippies, but about 1,000 policemen.
Well, bad ratio.
Yeah, I think they turned up to see if any of us were smoking dope.
That was the usual reason, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, those days are gone.
Sadly.
So are you looking forward to playing at the Glastonbury Festival?
I never look forward to Glastonbury. I usually enjoy it once I'm up on stage, but it's a logistical nightmare.
It is.
The last time I played there about 5 years ago, I couldn't get in.
No.
It took us 2 hours to get into the festival, and we're supposed to be, you know, artists and all that stuff. So you go to the artist entrance, which is clearly marked, you know, letter E or something.
Mm.
And then they say, oh, no, sorry, no, you're in totally the wrong place. You've got to drive, you know, 5 miles around to the other side of the festival to letter C, you know. You go to letter C, oh, no, they told you letter C. No, it's letter B, silly. You know. So we basically tried everything, you know, to get in. Eventually, we succeeded. It's fun to play. It's like a sort of instant refugee camp, really, in many ways. And I think I'm done with chemical toilets as a fallback. I know people love it, and people say, "Hey, you're playing Glastonbury? Wow, fantastic!" I'm happy when I'm actually up on stage.
Yeah, I'm like you. I kind of tip my toe in, but I'm not really one for sort of hanging around. And also, when you're standing in front of the pyramid stage with 80,000 people watching somebody, you can't really absorb it. It's crazy.
Yeah, there are moments when it all gets too big, doesn't it? Perhaps festivals should have a size limit of sort of 20,000, you know. So, yeah, when you get to like 100,000 or more, it gets truly insane. And it becomes, you know, a less musical experience. You know, you're watching people up on a screen.
Sure.
And in a sense, you're there for the event rather than really able to deal with the music. I think it becomes a bit too abstract, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, but people love it. People really absolutely love it.
Of course they do, especially the younger crowd. But how do you deal with people holding up phones and filming you?
I wish they didn't. Yeah. I think. I think it's robbing them of
an experience.
The experience of actually being in the room listening to live music. They're kind of mediating that experience for later, and I'm not sure that that's really good. And also, if it interferes with people around them. I'm not a fan of that either. So someone's kind of elbowing people out of the way so that they can get a nice clear picture.
Yeah.
I think that's rather antisocial, and maybe they shouldn't do that. Sometimes I'm grateful when I see a concert that I thought was long lost to oblivion, really, and someone actually has some footage of it, and I think, well, I'm kind of glad they did that. So I feel a bit mixed about it, really. If people can do it unobtrusively, then I'm not too bothered.
No.
If it enters the realms of antisocial, then I'm not so sure.
I saw David Byrne perform a few years ago, and he invited everybody to film a particular song, and then at the end of it he said, post it online and now put your phones away.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Yeah. That's a great idea. I saw a Pretenders concert where Chrissie Hynde was absolutely adamant that people should not use their phones. And she said, I think three times during the concert, if you don't put that phone away, then I'm off, I'm gone. She was really, really angry that people would do that.
Well, it is a spiritual experience, I think, performing on stage. And you have to have that connection with the audience. There is an unseen force that sort of bonds you both together. Do you feel that?
Absolutely, yeah. I can feel it, especially playing solo, if you like, where you're much more aware of the audience. The audience gets closer to you. Yeah, you almost pull the audience into you. And in that situation, it seems that everybody in the room is an element in the performance. And it's a part of the music. Everybody contributes. Yeah, you happen to be the conduit through which the music flows. But in other senses, you're just, you're one of many in the room. And it's a shared experience. And as you say, it's almost like a religious experience. When it gets really good, you could say it actually is quite a spiritual thing that happens. And I think the reward for the artist, for you, is that there's this sense of communication, that there's this sense of transference of something from you, to the audience. You're saying something on behalf of the audience. And on a good night, they'll receive something. They'll get some kind of emotion from you. It's hard to define, but there's definitely something goes on there. I mean, and it is a very precious thing. And if you start putting phones into it, it does get more complicated. It isn't quite as straightforward. So, I love playing live. I cherish it. And it's been a tough couple of years not having that as a resource.
Mm. Some people speak about a thing called the peak experience, where you're almost witnessing something in the subconscious that you can never grab again. I've heard that, for instance, Eric Clapton sometimes, when he's soloing on his guitar, finds himself in a position where he can't grab those moments back. They sort of come and then they've gone.
Yeah, it's definitely fleeting. Yes, I think you have that in improvisational situations. Yeah, you know, certainly playing a solo, on a guitar or whatever instrument, there are moments when you're kind of flying. Mm. I don't know what happens. I think you go into almost like a semi-conscious state, or your conscious brain switches off enough to allow your semi-conscious or subconscious to take over. And it's almost like you're playing subconsciously, but you're monitoring it with your conscious mind. So there's a part of you that knows that there's an F chord coming up, you know. Or that tricky diminished, you know, it's around the corner. And there's a part of you that knows, you know, that you've played 16 bars somehow, you know. But apart from that, it's like you're gone, you know. And it's a wonderful feeling. And I think you can have that... as a classical musician, just playing the notes that are written in the same way, you get to a point where you get lost in the interpretation.
Yeah, it's an internal
conflict. Yeah, and it's taking you somewhere you haven't been before. I think that's the exciting thing. It's like you're exploring somewhere and you think, well, no one's been here before. Mm. No one's been to this place before. And it'll be different tomorrow, and it'll be different the day after that. And some nights, you know, the PA is terrible, or you know, there's a noisy bar clank clanking away, and you think, well, you know, we'll just get through this. You know, tomorrow's another day. You know, this is not going to be one of those nights because it's just too difficult. But you know, on the good nights, that's the reward for, you know, cancelled flights and you know, uncomfortable hotel rooms and all the other stuff that you put up with as a travelling musician.
Yeah, I had that the other night with three drunk men. And me playing an acoustic guitar and them trying to dance to. And I was thinking, why has God put these three men in this room with me? What am I learning here?
You're being tested, clearly.
Stay sober.
Yeah.
That subconscious state of mind, are you there when you're writing songs?
Same thing. When it's going well, you get lost in the writing process, and it's almost like automatic writing. You know, something takes over. And you disappear for a while, and then you look down and there's stuff written on the page, you know, and you think, wow, that's brilliant. You know, I'm trying to write a song, but it's difficult. I'm struggling with this song. I've been working on it for weeks, so I keep coming back to it because I believe that, you know, this is my masterpiece. You know, this is going to be really fantastic. But meanwhile, I'm writing stuff in the margins. You know, I'm writing, I'll just write this down because it's, you know, and I'll write this down over here. And I realize that I'm never actually going to finish the song I want to. But meanwhile, I've written, you know, three other songs without really thinking about it, which is kind of the way it should work. You know, it's just that thing of getting the conscious mind out of the way. It's getting to that point where you can kind of switch, you know, the prefect off. You know, the part of you that's monitoring everything. You can just switch that off for a while. And then you can really start to write. Mm. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're a prose writer or a poet or whatever. You know, it's getting to that state. And everybody has a different way of getting to that point. If you improve as a writer, you get to that point quicker. You know, you don't write better stuff necessarily, but you can get to that point more efficiently, I think.
Are you disciplined?
Partially, yes.
Partially disciplined.
Parts of me are disciplined.
I mean, can you put aside time to write?
Yes,
you can.
Yeah, I think that's important. If you can do it, I've tried to train myself to write anywhere. You know, having kids, you know, I think you have to just, you know, blast through, you know, teething and God knows what, you know, just to get ideas down. If I have a week where I can say, okay, I'm just going to write this week, I find that really effective. But because sometimes it can take you 2 days just to get in the right state of mind, you know, to get relaxed enough and get the old brain turned off. To actually start really getting stuff down. And I find the more days I can string together, the better. So if I can do a week, if I can do 2 weeks where I'm just writing every day, you know, 7 a.m. Just 7 a.m. to noon is fine. And then if it's going well, you say, well, I'll keep going. Otherwise, you say, well, you know, I'll go to Sainsbury's, you know, this afternoon. Or I'll go for a walk. You know, if it's going really well, you might just keep going all afternoon and all evening, you know, because you're on a roll. The longer I can do that, the better. And then I find I reach a point of exhaustion where I have to force myself to stop. you know, the ideas keep coming, but I just say I'm too knackered. Mm. I've got to go and watch a movie or something to clear my head out. So, I love those spells where I can just really just write and write and write. And it's great, you know, if you have a deadline or something, just to be able to do that. You know, otherwise I just jot ideas down all the time and I'm working sort of steadily all the time. Mm. You know, an hour here, an hour there, you know, whatever it takes. Mm. And, you know, being a guitar player, then, you know, I kind of practice guitar on a fairly regular basis. And that gives you ideas as well. Mm. You know, that can lead you into songwriting, just noodling around. You know, you say, oh, I just found something. That's nice, you know. Mm. So it's an ongoing process. It never ends, really.
So when you were a teenager, did you have that discipline then, or were you just sort of falling about all over the place?
Less discipline. Well, I used to think, you know, I'm going to be more creative later in the day.
Yeah.
You know, I go through my normal day, and then I think, okay, it's midnight. I'm going to start writing now, you know. And then it would take me, you know, a few hours to get in the mood. And then, you know, about sort of 5 in the morning, sort of 5 to 5.15, I'd have sort of a moment of clarity. and then I'd fall asleep.
Yeah,
basically.
Of course.
That'd be too knackered. So it was incredibly inefficient, really. But somehow I managed to write a few songs as a teenager. But, I kept reading about people who started early in the day. A lot of prose writers, you know, this 6 a.m., like Hemingway. Mm. Regardless of what time he went to bed, you know, regardless of how absolutely smashed he was, he'd be up at 6 in the morning and he'd be, he typed standing up, you know, he had that sort of thing, and he'd write his, you know, 400 words for the day and that was it, and then knock off.
Incredible.
You know, Beethoven up at 6 in the morning, made the most phenomenally powerful cup of coffee. You know, he counted, I forget how many, like 70 coffee beans or something. Something ridiculous. You know, so the spoon would stand up in the bloody thing, you know. and then off he'd go, you know, accelerando, you know, allegretto.
Have you researched this? People getting up at...
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I've read articles about it, and then I've read sort of biographies of different writers and composers. There was a wonderful thing called the Paris Review, which I don't know if it's still going. Probably is. Where that they'd interview, you know, a writer every month, and it would be, you know, a huge range of different writers, but it would talk about their modus operandi and you know, how differently that they worked. But a lot of them wrote in the morning, which I thought was interesting. You know, they'd knock off at 12. I mean, Beethoven knocked off at 12 o'clock, and then he'd have lunch or he'd go and visit his friends. You know, he'd go to the theatre, go for long walks. You know, it wasn't like he switched off, but he'd stop, you know, physically writing. You know, so he writes sort of 6 hours a day, and that was it. I mean, I've always been fascinated by the creative process and how different people deal with it. I forget who the writer was, but it was a prose writer, and she wanted to build herself a writing space. She didn't have a space in her house, but she thought, well, I could convert the cupboard under the stairs. Which so many British homes have, of course. And she got the builder to sort of, you know, clean it all out and put a little desk in there and a little chair and everything. And the lighting was perfect and everything. and she got all her pens laid out in a row and got all her sheets of paper all nicely done on her favourite stationery.
Yeah.
And she could never actually bring herself to go into that room, ever.
Oh, my God.
And she kept, you know, just typing in the kitchen. You know, that was just, you know. Somehow there was a barrier to the creative process of actually going into the room that you created as the creative space.
Trains are very good for the subconscious to open up, I find. There's so much going on in your eyes and your mind that it opens up the subconscious for your imagination to spring.
I agree. Upstairs on the bus in London, I find a really creative space. I find that just wonderful. It's like dream world, you know, you're sort of floating along, looking down on the world, and it's almost like you can look down on your life and your problems, you know, it's all just down there. And then you're sort of bouncing along, and as you say, there's all this stimulus that seems to help the process, you know. And again, a lot of creative people are working in cafes. You know,
absolutely,
it's sort of you know, it's a public and yet it's a private space. You know, it's a public space where people will leave you alone. And so, you know, you're left your own devices, you know, you can read the paper, you can, you know, have your cup of coffee, whatever you want to do. But also you can write there, you know, it's another creative place, I find.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling very successful writing in a cafe.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, she did okay.
Yeah, she did
all right. I believe.
Yeah. In every episode of I Never Thought It Would Happen, we hear from an artist who's benefited directly from Help Musicians and learn a little about their experiences and the support the charity provides.
I'm Lara Jones and I'm based in Wolverhampton, London currently, and I'm a composer, producer, saxophonist, improviser and collaborator. So I got into music because we were very lucky we had a piano in our house, and I always wanted to learn it sort of from the moment I could speak. Just had this feeling that I wanted to play it. My mum said to me that you're going to have to wait until you can reach the keys. And I've got an older brother and he started to learn the piano. And I was really inspired by, you know, hearing him learn his C major scale, I suppose it probably was at the time. And then eventually when I was 5, my mum said, okay, right, yeah, you can reach the keys now. We'll get you some lessons. And I absolutely loved it. We moved to Scotland a few years later. The school there got me playing the clarinet. That was good, I kind of enjoyed it a bit. It was very close to the instrument I wanted to play, but it wasn't quite the right thing. And again, my brother, he was learning to play saxophone. And I thought, oh, I think I want to play that. It wasn't until I was about 18 that I started to learn saxophone. And from that point, I just knew that's what I wanted to do. I just absolutely loved it. I started studying Leeds College of Music, classical saxophone there. And it was a kind of quite a long journey for me to find my own sound and my own voice and the direction I wanted to go in. And I got into electronic music. I just knew that I wanted to make music, I knew that I wanted to write music, I knew that I loved sound. I was always like very interested by sound as a child, and that sort of carried through. I said from the age of 7, I said, I'm going to be a musician when I'm older. And here we are now, and that's what I do. A major high point for me was receiving the Peter Whittingham Jazz Award. I'd applied for it a few times, and then I got it sort of just before lockdown, or during the lockdown, I think it was. That time's slightly hazy for me now. And that was just great. I got some mentoring from Chris Sharkey. He's an amazing music maker, plays guitar, and amazing producer. And we kind of worked on developing my own sound as a producer. And so that was really, really special. And also, I've recently completed a commission that was funded by Jerwood Arts and co-commissioned by Cheltenham Jazz Festival and Manchester Jazz Festival. And I've spent the past couple of years building an audiovisual geodesic dome. And I placed it in Manchester Piccadilly train station inside where these visuals that I filmed across train journeys that I'd taken, and speakers inside the dome that played my album Enzo. That was my debut album, saxophone, electronics, and lots of field recordings I collected on these train journeys that I'd taken. And lots of the music was kind of inspired and written and even produced and mixed on trains and in train stations. So that was a really special moment. So I found out about Help Musicians through Leeds College of Music. I'm sure during the Freshers Week they had a stall there, and Help Musicians gave me the Peter Whittingham Jazz Award, which is amazing. They helped me release my second album, Flow, which was quite a pivotal moment as well. It was during lockdown and it kind of helped me develop this new sound as well. So that was a really special time. I think in terms of asking for help, I think sometimes we feel like we need to always be showing that we're okay and that we're working really hard. And actually I think it's okay to admit, okay, you know, I'm having a week where I'm not feeling creatively inspired, or I'm actually just really tired, like, you know, I've come off tour, and it's okay to take a break. I think it's hard as well when you love what you do so much, you kind of don't ever really want to stop. My advice would be, you know, if you can, do listen to how you're feeling and do what you need, because it's okay. And yeah, I think I've found over the past few years, especially with the lockdown, just chatting to people that are like-minded as well, that really helps, and to be able to share how you're feeling and even just what you're up to and what you're trying to work on, that can be really useful.
You can discover how to support Help Musicians and you can find them on all social media platforms, or you can go to their website at helpmusicians.org. What was the first record that you remember buying?
Oh gosh, well, it was bought for me. For some reason, I requested A Four-Legged Friend by Roy Rogers. This is when I was four, I believe. I heard it on the radio, probably heard it on you know, children's favourites back in the day. You know, we're talking in 1953 here.
Yeah.
And, you know, on the label it said, you know, Four-Legged Friend by Roy Rogers, brackets and trigger. the horse, right? Because at the end, you know, that you hear, nah, you trigger, or like, you know, a Mel Blanc or someone, you know, doing a horse
a trigger
at the end.
Yeah.
And significantly, the B-side was a song called There's a Cloud in My Valley of Sunshine. And I think that's influenced my slightly depressive writing style ever since. So it just kind of stayed with me. You know, I thought that was just a great song title.
Oh, God, I'd love to hear that. Is it good?
Yeah. There's a cloud in my valley of sunshine. Da 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 dee da da. Yeah, so it was a classic kind of, you know, almost, you know, kind of Sons of the Pioneers era, you know, kind of that sort of wholesome cowboy country, you know.
Mm.
Wholesome stuff.
So there was lots of music in your house when you were growing up, I guess.
Yeah, I think all families in those days had, you know, the record player or the radiogram, you know. So you'd listen to the radio.
Yeah.
And, you know, records were sort of a precious thing, really. Because, you know, no one had thousands. You'd have sort of 50 or 100 records.
Sure.
But they meant a lot to you. And, you know, first of all, it was my dad's record collection.
Mm.
So in among, you know, the fairly, you know, less interesting stuff. You know, it's all the show tunes, first of all. They're like, you know, they're from
Oklahoma,
The King and I, West Side Story. Yeah, no, that's all great stuff. I mean, it's fantastic stuff to grow up listening to.
Mm.
And then, you know, the Glenn Miller, the kind of predictable swing stuff. But you know, also Duke Ellington, all the early Louis Armstrong. My father was a huge Louis Armstrong fan, so we got all that stuff. And Les Paul, you know, like Les Paul 78s.
Mm.
And French records. My father was still in Belgium a couple of years after the war finished, doing kind of, you know, strange police stuff. He came back with a pile of French records. They were just wonderful.
Mm.
You know, La Mer by Charles Trenet,
mm-hmm.
Jean Sablon records, Edith Piaf records.
Mm.
So I kind of grew up with that as well, which is wonderful.
Mm.
I mean, Scottish music as well, like Scottish dance music
going
on. And then when my sister became a consumer about the age of 11 or 12, that then we got the rock and roll records from the very beginning, from Bill Haley, pretty much, onwards. And my sister was a huge Buddy Holly fan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so we had basically the entire Buddy Holly collection
yeah.
You know, plus, you know, Gene Vincent, like, you know, the dangerous stuff, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis, you know, the real spirit of rock and roll, the kind of, the, you know, the anti-establishment,
yeah,
you know, the voice of teenage post-war angst, rock and roll, you know, and a bit of Tommy Steele, of course. You know, the local ads, and I think we had a couple of Joe Brown records as well, which is nice.
And was that where you got your taste for wanting to be in a band or to be in the music business?
A taste to play the guitar.
Mm.
And I was asking for guitars from about the age of five.
Really?
You know?
Wow.
Yeah, but, you know, I got fobbed off with toys.
Mm.
And, you know, finally, my dad brought home a broken guitar from the West End, which he kind of glued back together again. And, you know, I won the competition, you know, as to who was going to play it. You know, my dad thought he was going to play it. My sister thought she was going to play it. But, you know, I just grabbed it and you know, and held onto it very tightly. And
thankfully.
Yeah, and this is when you know, the Shadows were starting out. So you had, like, Apache. And so myself and my friend from around the corner both started playing the guitar. And that was the nucleus of a band. And eventually we added, you know, a drummer and... But that became, you know, the school band. And then, you know, I met the Fairport guys when I was about 15, 16. And then that became the basis of Fairport. And then...
Where did you meet those guys?
Let me think. Well, you know, we went to different schools. But I had a school friend who lived basically next door to Ashley Hutchings, the bass player. And that's how I met Ashley. And then I met Simon through Ashley, Simon Nicol.
Mm.
Basically, it was the three of us, a kind of various drummers, and until we settled on a real drummer.
Mm.
And, you know, that was basically it.
Was that around the time when you met Joe Boyd?
Yeah, Joe's a little bit later. I mean, I think we'd only actually been professional. So I was 18. I think, you know, I'd left school in May 67. And we gigged through that summer. And I think by like July or August, we were playing at the UFO Club, which was kind of miraculous, really. I suppose we had an agent at that point. And we were professional. I think we'd been professional maybe 2 months when we met Joe. And he was clearly, like, you know, a kindred spirit. You know, he loved roots music. He loved traditional music. He loved jazz. He loved all the stuff that we loved. And I think he recognized in us that we were definitely on the same page. And it was great to be part of Joe's stable, if you like. You know, the incredible string band and John Martin.
Incredible,
And
John Wood.
And John Wood, of course, a wonderful engineer. One of the absolute greatest engineers I've ever worked with.
He's still around. He lives in Aberdeen.
I know, and he's still the engineers Chris Difford records.
He did one for me, but but when somebody said, can you work the Pro Tours? And he said, only if I can wear my gardening gloves.
It's a good line.
Yeah, but the first time we ever recorded with him, I always remember his Aran jumper that he had, and he had a ruler, and if you touched the desk, he would hit the back of your hand with it.
Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. You know, John has ears. You know, that's, you know,
absolutely.
It's such a thing. You know, he doesn't need computers to tell him, you know, that, you know, the frequencies of things or a room sounds like. You'll just walk into a room and say, okay, that's it. You know, put that over there, put that over there, you know, put the drums over there. There's not too many engineers that are actually to that degree, you know, have got, you know, just incredible ability to hear, you know, and to know how to reproduce natural sound, particularly, you know, really, you know, to take acoustic music and to turn it into something extraordinary. You know, you listen to like a Nick Drake record or something, recorded, you know, way back, you know, recorded in the 60s, and it just sounds like it was recorded yesterday, and it sounds like it's in your living room, and it just sounds like natural sound. You know? So it sounds beautiful.
I remember going in the studio with Phil Brown, the engineer,
and
he just set up three microphones for the entire drum kit, and I was like, aren't you going to use any more? He said, no, that's all you need.
Yeah, well, it's just true. Yeah.
Have you found anybody like that to work with these days?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with lots of really good engineers, there's no question. But John stands out, you know. Bruce Botnick was another engineer who really stood out for me as being something extraordinary. And engineers, sadly, I can't even remember the names of. One wonderful engineer at Fantasy Studios, which isn't there anymore, sadly. Wonderful studio in San Francisco, where they recorded, I mean, incredible stuff, you know, just amazing stuff. And he was just extraordinary. Keith Grant, another great engineer who used to run Olympic Studios.
Yes, right, yeah.
He was another of those guys who just, you know, you'd just be sitting around, you know, in the studio playing like off mic, and he'd just put a mic in front of you, and it would sound like $1 million. I mean, you know, just one of those people, you know.
Yeah. When you listen back to your early records, are you satisfied by them, or do you find fault in them, or do they just link you to an emotion and a relationship that you would rather not go to?
I'm always, you know, I think ambivalent about records. I'm always amazed to listen back to a record and think, oh, that's better than I remember. But I usually think, well, I wish I'd left off, you know, a couple of tracks.
Right.
I'm usually not satisfied with the material. And I wish that I'd persevered a bit more or taken longer over a record. A lot of early records that we did so fast.
Yeah.
I want to see the Bright Lights Tonight, which was a sort of 1973 record. We did in about 3 days. I know it cost £2,500, you know, including, you know, going to Manchester to overdub brass players, you know, but paying the band, you know, paying for the studio. You know, it's like you had to get it right the first time, and on that record we got lucky. I think of other records where we were going equally fast because of budget, and we didn't get so lucky. You know, we were writing the songs, you know, a bit too quickly, maybe, you know, and not living up to our high standards, whatever they were. So, yeah, listen back to records, and I, you know, sometimes I squirm, you know.
Yeah, those records with Linda sound amazing.
Yeah, I mean, they sound good. They sound fantastic.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I just wish mostly that I could ditch some of the songs, you know,
yeah.
And sometimes the performances as well, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
from just about every record I've ever made, really, truly. Yeah, it's tough. You know?
How do you feel about making records now that, you know, I know from my point of view, I think about it, well, it's going to cost this much, I'm not really going to sell that many. You know,
it's
kind of just like a plank to get across the river, isn't it, really?
It is, the proverbial plank. How do I feel about it? Well, you know, I think I have to think about the budget. And, you know, yeah, how much do I want to spend? How much can I make on this record? How many am I going to sell? Who can I get interested in releasing it? And as you say, you know, sometimes it's just, it's a break-even exercise. If I can break even, great. And, you know, this record will fuel my next tour, really. You know, this will fuel a year's touring. And touring's really the only place where you actually make money these days. You don't make money from your intellectual property, from songwriting. I think songwriting used to be half my income.
Right.
Back in, what, the 90s or something, 80s, 90s. It was probably half my income, 50%.
Yeah.
And now it's about 5%.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So that's a massive drop. And when people complain about, you know, ticket prices of live music, you know, it wasn't me that started putting the prices up, but, you know, all musicians are facing the same dilemma where that's the only place where you actually earn money.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unless you're big enough to have some influence over Spotify or something.
Which we don't.
Which we don't, yeah. And, you know, the record companies are now sort of part owners of Spotify, so they keep as much as they can and don't pass it off onto you as the artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange world.
Somebody said to me the other day, why don't you put out a song every day on TikTok? And I thought, no, thank you.
Oh, God, yes.
I can't think of anything worse.
Which is giving away, like, you know, everything, yeah.
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 What about the book? Did you get great pleasure writing the book, and are you working on another one?
I enjoyed it a lot. Once I got going, you know, I needed some encouragement, but once I got into the process, I really enjoyed it. I thought, this is great fun, you know. I'm very different, and it's entering a very different world, which I was surprised by. You know, the publishing world, you know, it moves much slower. You got a whole different range of people, a different kind of people. These very intellectual, very smart people, very nice people, who work at a whole different pace and expect different things from you, and treat you very differently from what can be a sort of sycophantic world of music. So, you know, I got my wrist slapped frequently, which was fine. I enjoyed that. And it was sort of amazing to be edited. I'd never been edited as a songwriter. Never been edited, you know, that much as just a performing musician, you know. And, you know, I'd say, what? You know, you're asking me to change something? And, of course, they were always right. I mean, absolutely every single time that they were right about everything. So, yeah, it was fun. I'm working on something. I don't want to do another, just like a linear, you know, this year to this year kind of thing. Yeah. But I want to do a more like a bits and pieces, episodic, you know, just picking out fragments here and there and kind of stringing them together into what will basically be a bunch of short stories, I suppose. But it would still be fact rather than fiction.
Yeah, and of course your fans, as they grow older, they prefer, well, they don't prefer, but they enjoy a good read, so they will buy the book.
Yeah, it's either me or the Daily Telegraph, so, you know.
Yeah, indeed.
Or the Sun. You know.
Or the Sun, no. So, you know, you've got a great family dynasty with lots of people playing on your family tree, just like the Wainwrights. It's incredible. And I'm drawn very much to the talents that you have within your field. Just recently I've been working with Zach, who's an extraordinary musician.
He is.
You know, a squeeze songs are not easy to play, and I needed no rehearsal.
Okay, yeah, he does his homework. He's a diligent boy. Yeah, he's a fantastic player. I mean, he plays stuff I can only dream of, really. You know, how old is that? He's like 26 or something. Yeah, I mean, he's been a prodigy since he was about 15. And I'm glad that he's getting work. You know, thank you for employing my grandson. That's great. And yeah, he's working with my son Teddy as well, which is nice.
Teddy's amazing, yeah.
Teddy's a great singer-songwriter too. Mm, so
he really is.
It's nice to have that. And my daughter Cammy as well is a really wonderful singer and songwriter. So it's nice that some kids took up the family business.
Yeah.
And even though I advised them not to, I said, you know, this is a world of frustration and non-remuneration. But if you have to do it, you have to do it. I hope they'd be, you know, car mechanics or accountants. something useful to me.
So Help Musicians is a charity that gave out over £20 million during the pandemic. Have you heard of anything like that before? It's extraordinary, isn't it?
It's absolutely fantastic. And boy, so many musicians needed it. It's been a really tough couple of years. As if it isn't tough anyway for musicians. You know, the flooding in New Orleans was another
disaster.
You know, musical disaster, you know. So it's been a lifesaver, really, literally a lifesaver for so many people. So it's a wonderful charity, and I'm glad to be supporting it.
That's great. Well, Richard, thank you very much for your time.
It's very kind
of you to come on this little podcast. It will definitely help.
I'm glad to hear it. Thanks for having me. It's good to see you too.
See you at Glastonbury.
Okay.
Behind the picket fences.
Exactly, yeah. See you there. Fantastic. All the best.
That was a fascinating insight into a songwriting process. And in that regard, Richard and I have much in common. Though I have to say, it wasn't Roy Rogers who set my young heart aflame. But I'm definitely going to listen to There's a Cloud in My Valley of Sunshine as soon as I turn off this microphone. To find out more about the wonderful work Help Musicians do, have a look at their website for loads more information. And please subscribe to this podcast. Thank you once again for listening. Keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Give Me Sugar production for Help Musicians.